From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! What is George W. Bush's name doing on a list of donors to the Museum of the Confederacy? Also, on this day after the elections, a look at races and referenda around the country. Mainers say yes to medical marijuana and no to an anti-choice measure. San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown faces a runoff. Columbus elects its first black mayor. Virginia has a Republican legislature for the first time since Reconstruction. And in Philadelphia, Democrat John Street beats his Republican opponent in one of the closest races in the country. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown will have to survive a runoff next month to win re-election. Exactly who still wasn't clear early today. We'll have more on election coverage in just a few minutes. This news from Florida. A corrections officer has been charged with battery after a prisoner facing execution for killing a prison guard died after a confrontation with officers at Florida State Prison. Sergeant Montrez Lucas was charged with aggravated battery, battery on a prisoner, and coercion to influence a report, court records show. He had not been arrested as of yesterday. Lucas was one of nine guards suspended after Frank Valdez died July 17th following an altercation that started when the prisoner was being removed from his isolation cell on X-Wing for making threats to guards. A source close to the investigation confirmed the case against Lucas was in connection with the Valdez case. And this news from North Carolina, the FBI is making public a report on its plans for handling possibly violent extremists during the new millennium. A shortened version of the report, initially created for other policing agencies, is available on the Bureau's website. The FBI at first refused to release a copy of the document to reporters. The Washington Post reported Sunday it had obtained a copy. The report warns law enforcement officers that religious fanatics and New World Order conspiracy theorists could incite violence in the new millennium. Danny Glover is fed up with the treatment he gets from New York cab drivers. The 52-year-old actor says taxis pass him by because he's black and discriminate in other ways against black passengers. He's filing a complaint with the city agency that regulates cabs. He's also proposing more diversity training for drivers. Glover, who is best known for his Lethal Weapon movies, says he was bypassed several times one day last month by cabs in Manhattan. The 6'4" actor also says a driver refused to let him sit in the front seat, even though he had a hip injury and needed the room, and his daughter and a friend were in the back. A regulatory official promises to aggressively investigate Glover's complaints. Researchers reportedly have failed to notify the National Institutes of Health of six patient deaths during gene therapy experiments. Two researchers competing to be the first to grow new blood vessels around blocked ones tell the Washington Post they did not report the deaths to the agency because they did not believe the deaths were directly related to gene therapy. They say the deaths were caused by underlying illnesses. The deaths were reported to the Food and Drug Administration, which doesn't release the information. Last month, the FDA ordered Schering Plough Corporation to temporarily halt two gene therapy studies after a teenager in a similar experiment died. The face of poverty cuts across the entire country, but a Census Bureau report says the number of people living in poverty varies widely. According to the study, the percentage of poor people ranges from the single digits throughout most of the Northeast to more than 20% in some parts of the South. Nationally, 13.7% of Americans and 20.5% of children live in poverty. A pair of packages seized in a drug trafficking case against the wife of the former commander of the U.S. anti-drug operation in Colombia contained heroin, not cocaine, as first thought. Lorianne Hyatt, wife of Colonel James Hyatt, surrendered in August on drug conspiracy charges. Field tests had indicated two parcels she allegedly shipped to the United States from the U.S. Embassy in Bogota held 1.2 kilos of cocaine each. Hyatt became a suspect in May when her name appeared on the return address on one of the two packages, which was seized after a routine search by the Customs Service in Miami. The North Dakota Farmers Union is fighting the planned merger of two of the largest farmer-owned cooperatives in North America. The merger would unite Kansas City Farmland Industries and the continent's largest farmer-owned cooperative with Minnesota-based Senex Harvest States, a cooperative owned by farmers, ranchers, and local co-ops from the Great Lakes to the Pacific Northwest and from the Canadian border to Texas. And in international news, Judge Baltazar Bagarzon, who is the Spanish judge known for calling for the extradition of former Chilean dictator Pinochet, has indicted 98 Argentines for genocide, terrorism, and torture during the years of military rule in Argentina from 1976 to 1983. Buenos Aires has refused to cooperate with the judge who has sought the extradition of Augusto Pinochet, the former Chilean leader now being held in Britain.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to Democracy Now! Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners on this relatively quiet morning after elections, although there weren't many big ones around the country. But I understand that in Philadelphia, my old friend John Street was elected mayor of Philadelphia.
Juan, why don't we start off with Philadelphia? You reported for the Philadelphia Daily News for a long time, and this was a very close race, as you said, between the city council member John Street, who President Clinton last weekend went out and campaigned for, narrowly beating businessman Sam Katz, who almost became the city's first Republican mayor in 50 years. Who are these two people?
Well, actually, I know both Street and Katz very well, because when I was the education reporter at the Philadelphia Daily News in 1982 and 83, Sam Katz was a member of the Board of Education, a very vocal member of the board, always sort of a brash, young business type who actually I ended up writing a series of exposés about, because he made his career basically in financing schemes with a company called Public Financial Management. And I discovered at one point in 85 that while he was a consultant to the city on a new convention center that the city was about to build, he was also buying and selling land, helping to drive up the prices in the convention center footprint. And he was forced to resign his consultancy with the city afterwards. But Katz has attempted to sort of provide a sort of a more benign, moderate, progressive Republican perspective. And Street, on the other hand, came from a very grassroots movement in North Philadelphia. He and his brother Milton Street, who eventually became a state senator and died, they organized a massive squatters movement in North Philadelphia that was very powerful for quite a while in the early 80s. But then John rose to become first a member of city council and then the president of city council, he gradually took over the old Black Democratic Party machine in Philadelphia, and was very much considered by many of the progressives who had fought with him as basically having sold out and become very much part of the establishment. He was actually endorsed by Ed Rendell, the outgoing mayor. And it's no surprise that even though Philadelphia is overwhelmingly Democratic, that Street had such a close race, because many of the white Democrats deserted, I'm sure, the Democratic Party to vote for Katz, and that's why the race was so close.
Mm. Well, in Columbus, Ohio, voters elected the city's first black mayor, a Democratic city council president, Michael Coleman. And in Virginia, Republicans took control of both houses of the Virginia General Assembly for the first time since Reconstruction. We're also going to be talking about referenda around the country. But first, we're going to go to San Francisco, where Democrat Willie Brown, who is seeking a second term, has been forced into a runoff by a crowded field of candidates. Joining us on the line right now from Berkeley is Aaron Glantz. He is a reporter with KPFA, Pacifica Station in Berkeley. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Aaron.
It's good to be up this morning.
Well, can you tell us about this race and the significance of Willie Brown being forced into a runoff?
Well, it's interesting that you would use the word Democratic, Amy, because, you know, in San Francisco, everyone's a Democrat. It's a one-party town. It's kind of interesting to listen to these other cities where there is a Democrat and a Republican. Willie Brown looms incredibly large here in San Francisco. He has the support of every interest group in the town with money, whether that's labor or the Chamber of Commerce. He has the endorsement of 9 of the 11 members of the Board of Supervisors. He had a pre-recorded phone message from President Clinton that went out during phone banking. But about 3 weeks before the election, Board of Supervisors President Tom Amiano, the city's highest-ranking gay elected official, launched a write-in campaign to his left, and the ballots will still be counted for almost a week, but it's clear that this is going to be going to a runoff.
And given that he had all of these endorsements, why was he not able to get a much larger segment of the vote, supposedly?
Well, there's a lot of frustration in San Francisco, and Willie Brown, before he was mayor of San Francisco, was Speaker of the State Assembly for 15 years. He was called the Ayatollah of the Assembly. He's a very powerful politician. Almost everyone in politics in California owes him something. But he hasn't been able to fix the public transportation system in San Francisco Muni, which was one of his major campaign promises. He hasn't been able to solve the problem of homelessness. And under his watch, housing prices of San Francisco have more than doubled over 4 years. So there's a lot of frustration that people have all around the political spectrum. Amiano was not the only candidate who was running against him. One of them was the former mayor, a former police chief by the name of Frank Jordan that he ousted in the previous race. And I think that it's reasonably accurate to say that even though he's supported by almost every interest group, his public support is not that deep. But then again, here, you know, the morning after, he does appear to have 48% of the vote, far more than any of his challengers.
Aaron Glantz, a reporter with Pacifica Station KPFA on the mayoral race in San Francisco. We're also joined by John Gollinger from San Francisco, who's with the consumer, with the California Public Interest Research Group. There was a very interesting referendum that was on the ballot in San Francisco that I think a lot of people are going to look at around the country. And maybe you can tell us a little about it.
Sure, Amy. Well, I mean, this is literally a great day to be a consumer in San Francisco, and I think a banker's worst nightmare. Proposition F, which was also on the ballot yesterday, makes San Francisco the first city by voter initiative to bar banks from charging those double ATM surcharge fees at ATMs in the city. This is a consumer revolt, I think, of the clearest nature. It's an issue that hits voters both in the pocketbook, but I think more than most consumer abuses by big interests like banks. This is about your money and simply you, working people, seniors, your grandparents, getting back your own hard-earned money. Banks have figured out over the last decade or so ways to nickel and dime consumers in just about every clever way that a banker could dream. But these ATM fees, I think, have gone too far, and that's what the measure that looks like it passed by a overwhelming margin would put an end to.
John, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, other big banks spent nearly $400,000 in the effort to defeat Proposition F. But I'm just wondering, what could possibly have been their campaign? How could they, what could they argue?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, I've learned from this campaign that bankers don't get out very much. I think they spend a lot too much, a lot of their time in the back rooms in those those banks counting money and not talking to real people, because their campaign was really about, number one, empty threats. They literally threatened every consumer, every voter in San Francisco, that they would take away ATMs, that you'd be forced to cut up your ATM card. That's what some of the mailers they sent out to voters directly threatened. They also simply brought out the old lawyer card. And, I mean, banks, besides, I think the only thing that they may have just about as much of it as money is lawyers. And banks have threatened to take the city to court and drag the issue out as long as they possibly can, costing taxpayer dollars. But that's not what this is all about. This is really a consumer abuse. ATM fees are something that people have never thought are appropriate or right. And Proposition F looks like the first chance for voters to both send a message to big banks, but more importantly, put a stop to it and give other cities across the nation an example that they can also follow.
You know, it's interesting when you look at the amount of money that was spent. You see that in San Francisco, also New York. There was a very much too complicated charter revision that went down. Big defeat for Mayor Giuliani. But in that case as well, they way outspent those that ultimately won, which is interesting just for campaign finance reform advocates around the country. Juan?
Yes, and while the defeat of Giuliani's mixed bag of charter revision proposals was important in terms of how, getting a sense of his standing among the electorate, certainly the California vote on ATMs, to me, has to be probably the most significant one across the country, because everyone, as John has said, is upset across the country with these ATM fees. Just the idea that so many banks have closed down branches, and so it's that much harder now for anybody to find a branch nearby that they can do banking with. And after they spent 10 or 15 years conditioning the public to these machines, now that they move in to charge fees, when actually these ATM machines help them reduce costs by not having to employ people and operate branches. So they're charging the public for their ability to reduce their costs. It's astounding, and I think that hopefully the California initiative will spread to other states.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone by Galen Nelson, who is the director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Galen, before we talk about the number of referenda and the kind of issues that they dealt with around the country, do you see this ATM surcharge defeat and the victory of Prop 5 catching on around the country? Do you see other referenda in the works?
Thanks for having me on the program, Amy, first off. Yeah, we've certainly caught wind of it, and we'd love to see it circulating in other states. I think it's a great issue. It's a great wedge issue. It's a populist issue, and as your other guests have clearly explained, this has long been a gross injustice on the part of banks and an unnecessary surcharge. So we hope to see it in other states.
Well, let's talk about these other referenda and what this means and just the whole philosophy behind referenda and initiatives in this country. How many were there?
We had not an incredibly large number of initiatives on the ballot yesterday. It's an off year, as you know, and there are only five states that regularly allow statewide citizen-initiated ballot measures and referenda. Oregon had a special election yesterday, and there were a number of referenda on the ballot there. But generally, there are five states that allow the process.
What do you mean that allow the process?
The initiative process is written into state constitutions in 24 states in the District of Columbia, and Colorado, Maine, Mississippi, Ohio, and Washington allow citizen-initiated ballot measures in odd-numbered years. The other states allow the measures in even years.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the Maine referendum. There were two, one an anti-choice initiative that went down and a medical marijuana initiative that was voted up. We're also going to talk about stadium referenda around the country. You are listening to Radio's Democracy Now!, our guest right now is Gaylen Nelson, who's the director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. And then after that, we're going to Texas, an expose on George W. Bush and what is his name doing on a donor list to the Museum of the Confederacy. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez on this day after the elections, big elections in a number of states, but also votes on referenda around the country. Our guest is Gaylen Nelson, who runs the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, and you can go to his website at www.ballot.org to find out all of the results of the referenda around the country. Gaylen, let's talk about Maine, the two initiatives, one on medical marijuana, the other against late-term abortions.
The late-term abortion ban was soundly defeated, 55-45%. We're not surprised that Maine voters saw through this misleading, vaguely worded ballot language. The abortion ban referendum in Maine wasn't really about solving a problem. It was ultimately an unsuccessful effort to drive a wedge between Maine's two pro-choice senators and the Maine electorate. It's actually a strategy that anti-choice groups have had for quite some time. They've been launching similar attempts to ban abortions in Congress with the federal so-called Partial Birth Abortion Act. Of course, partial birth is not a medical term. It's a term of right-wing rhetoric. Were it to become law, the act could gravely restrict abortion access even in the earliest stages of pregnancy. And, of course, Maine voters knew this when they defeated the measure yesterday. They knew that the measure could possibly ban abortions even in the first trimester. And as of October 21st, the U.S. Senate, I think for the third year in a row, passed the Partial Birth Abortion Act 63-34. And it's widely recognized that pro-choice senators Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe are two of the votes shy of the two-thirds majority that would be required to override a promised veto by President Clinton. So ironically, while Congress continues to pass this legislation and comes close to overriding the president's veto, every single time voters have confronted this issue at the ballot level, they've rejected it.
And the medical marijuana initiative, could you tell us a little
bit about that?
Medical
marijuana initiative also passed pretty handily, joining a handful of other states that have passed similar measures. This was a medical use, as you say, issue, and it passed 62-38. That was with 84% of precincts reporting. That's probably how it will stand. So a positive development for those doctors and patients that believe that that's the most appropriate type of care with certain illnesses.
Now let's talk about the referenda around the country around stadiums, Gaylen Nelson. How many were there?
I'm not sure, Amy, actually. We weren't tracking some of the local measures, and I know that there were a handful of them.
Well, actually, we're also joined by Andrew Zimbalist, who's a professor of economics at Smith College. and co-author of the book Sports, Jobs, and Taxes, The Economic Impact of Sports Teams and Stadiums. Andrew Zimbalist, you were tracking these referenda.
Yes.
Tell us, how many were there?
There were four. There was one in Scottsdale, Arizona, one in San Antonio, Texas, one in St. Paul, Minnesota, and one in Houston, Texas.
And what happened?
The voters in Scottsdale and San Antonio voted to approve funding for two new arenas. One is a hockey, an NHL team, and the other is the basketball team, the Spurs. And the voters in St. Paul voted against a sales tax increase to build a new stadium for the Minnesota Twins. And the voters in Houston voted against tax increases to fund half of a new stadium for owner Leslie Alexander and the Houston Rockets.
Well, Andrew Zimbalist, from what you can tell, what was the difference between the Houston and St. Paul votes versus what happened in San Antonio and Scottsdale?
It's very, very complicated. If you go back over the last 10 years, you find roughly half of the initiatives pass and half don't. What influences the voters has to do with the local political culture. It has to do with the popularity of the specific team. It has to do with how well the team has done competitively in the previous year or two. It has to do with perceptions of the owner. It has to do with local taxes and perception of the local government. It has to do with the organizing ability of the opposition forces. It really is extraordinarily complex, and it's very hard to predict in the abstract how these things will turn out. As I say, it's about half and half, given that invariably the pro side, the side that says let's fund this with public money, is spending 10, 20, 30, 40 times more than the opposition. It's remarkable that the votes come out roughly half and half.
Let's talk about the politics of stadiums. I think the title of one of your books tells it well, Baseball and Billions, a probing look at the big business of our national pastime. But we know that George W. Bush, for example, part of his fortune, a big part of it, was investing in the Texas Rangers, spending about, $500,000-$600,000.
Yes.
And then after pushing for the stadium to be built for the Rangers, it increased their value, and he was able to sell at around $14-15 million.
Exactly, yeah. Well, George W. was made the lead partner, although he invested a very small share of the partnership group that bought the Rangers in the late 80s. He was made the lead partner with the understanding that he would be carrying the political ball, which he did. I mean, he had to convince local voters for public funding. He had to convince the state legislature to give bonding authority to Arlington. He had other political tricks that he had to turn, and he did it all. And in exchange for that, he was the lead partner until he became the governor. And of course, subsequent to that, his partnership sold out and made a very, very handsome profit. When you get a new stadium or a new arena, the value of your franchise can increase anywhere from $100 million to $300-500 million, depending on the circumstances. The owners of the sports teams are always interested in getting the latest model of an arena or stadium because they have more luxury boxes and more club seats and more opportunities for signage and more concessions and catering opportunities, more sponsorship opportunities, and it can bring the team anywhere from $10 to $50-60 million a year in additional revenue. And if you can get the public to pay for it, sure, why not support it? So what an owner does is he or she goes out and finds some local contractors, construction companies, construction unions, architectural firms, investment bankers, lawyers who work for investment bankers, a few affiliated business interests. They form a business coalition, which includes, generally speaking, you know, the largest players in a local political economy. They then enlist politicians, and they set about their campaign drive. One other facet is usually they hire a consulting firm to produce a bogus economic impact study that assures people that with their hundreds of millions of dollars will come a hefty economic return. Those hefty economic returns never materialize, but that's basically what happens. And up against that juggernaut of a political coalition, you get opposition groups, you get rank-and-file citizen groups who don't have nearly the financial resources to publicize their message. So again, it's quite remarkable that half of these votes end up turning down the public funding.
Well, Andrew Zimbalist, we had a situation in New York here where actually a referendum was not allowed on the ballot by those who wanted the George Steinbrenner's New York Yankees to have the city build a $1 billion stadium.
This wouldn't be the same mayor who's trying to tell what kind of art is allowable.
Yes, the same mayor, and he actually went to court to stop a referendum from being on the ballot.
Yes, he did, and
because he knew he was going to lose it.
Yeah.
But there you had a situation where the whole team, the New York Yankees, is supposedly not worth $1 billion.
No, they're
but
not.
The city would build a $1 billion stadium. They could just as well invest the money and buy the team, and then have a regular revenue stream coming into the city coffers.
Yeah. Absolutely, and you know the other thing that's important to point out here, Juan, is that these numbers that get thrown around, that $1.06 billion figure that was being used for the stadium on 33rd Street and 11th Avenue, is just an initial estimate. And invariably, there are enormous cost overruns, and sometimes the cost overruns can be 30-50%. Sometimes they could be 100%. The renovations that were done to Yankee Stadium in 1974 and 75 were supposed to cost $19 million, and they ended up costing about $110 million. So that $1 billion, as large as it is, was just an initial estimate.
So you think voters are catching on, taxpayers catching on around the country, Andrew Zimbalist?
Well, yeah, obviously they're catching on. But, you know, the other element here is that these sports leagues are monopolies. There's only one top-level football league, only one top-level baseball and basketball and hockey league. They're monopolies, and what all monopolists do is they restrict output and then charge a higher price. And the way the leagues do this is they restrict the number of franchises relative to the demand from economically viable cities for those franchises. So cities are always competing against each other, and if the fans don't provide these subsidies, there's always the threat that the team is going to move, and there's certainly that threat right now for the Twins. And similarly, there's a threat that Leslie Alexander is going to move his Houston Rockets. You know, whatever else you might think about these subsidies, the fact of the matter is that professional sports is enormously popular in our culture, and it would hurt large segments of the population, psychically hurt them, if the team was lost. And even though these stadiums and teams don't have an economic benefit to speak of, they do have a cultural benefit, and the leagues are able to use their monopoly power to play off of that cultural popularity and extract these subsidies. So it's dangerous. It's not it's fairly easy for a city like New York to tell Steinbrenner to stuff it, because Steinbrenner's got a $55 million local cable contract, and he's not going to be able to get that in some other city, even if he can get a new stadium in some other city. He also happens to have a jewel of a stadium in Yankee Stadium. But Steinbrenner can make all the threats he wants. If he moves, he's nuts. And moreover, Major League Baseball probably wouldn't let him move. So New York citizens have a lot of bargaining leverage. They can say no to Steinbrenner as much as they like, and it's very, very unlikely that they're going to lose their baseball team. But if a city like St. Paul or Houston says no, then they might lose. So it's a little bit riskier for them. And indeed, as you might recall, the people of Houston lost their football team a few years ago, and now they're being forced to build the new stadium to get a football team back.
And in terms of the ability of citizens to organize networks, organizations, has there been much success in terms of grassroots organization on some of these proposals?
I can't tell you the details of what went on in Houston. I know there's been a lot of grassroots activity in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area. There was a lot of grassroots activity in Boston when the Patriots were trying to use the South End in Boston to build a new stadium for themselves. and the citizens of South Boston very, very effectively organized. And again, well, so once again, I think that in some of these cases, there's tremendous local organization. There, in Springfield, Massachusetts, close to where I live right now, there's a tremendous local citizens' organization against public funding for a minor league stadium. So I think, once again, it varies quite a bit from one situation to another.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Andrew Zimbalist, for joining us. Andrew,
my pleasure.
Zimbalist, speaking to us from Smith College, professor there, and also author of several books on the issue of stadiums. Andrew Zimbalist's books, one of them called Baseball and Billions, and the other book called Sports, Jobs, and Taxes, the Economic Impact of Sports Teams and Stadiums. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim. Behind a man's brain, but he can't be blamed. He's only.
Well, the 1997-1998 annual report of the Museum of the Confederacy, which is based in Richmond, Virginia, in it, George W. Bush is listed as a donor to the Lone Star Ball, which is a fundraising event of the museum. In the Bush campaign, when we gave them a call to ask specifically about this issue, they said that they were not ready to respond, but the museum did and said that the governor had sent a letter of support to the attendees of the event, the Lone Star Ball, which was held at the Tredegar Ironworks Gun Foundry building, the place where Civil War armaments were produced for the Confederacy. The museum is known as a place that celebrates achievements of soldiers of the Confederacy, and the Lone Star Ball was honoring Texas last year. Each year it honors another state. Before that, it honored South Carolina. The Lone Star Ball flew the Confederate flags of all the states of the Confederacy. People came, hundreds of people in period clothing. And today we're going to take a look at, the Museum of the Confederacy and George Bush's involvement. We're joined by Ed Sebesta, who is a researcher on the neo-Confederate movement. Ed, can you tell us what you found about this event and George Bush's involvement?
Well, I found in page 37 in the fiscal report, 1997-98, they've listed as a donor to fundraising events the Lone Star Ball. It's a short list, and it provides the upfront money for the ball. He also has written letters of congratulations to the United Daughters of the Confederacy and also wrote a letter of congratulations to Sons of Confederate Veterans for their 100th anniversary.
We got a copy from the Museum of the Confederacy of George Bush's letter that he wrote to the attendees of the Lone Star Ball. That was the big celebration of the Museum of the Confederacy last year. And in the letter, he says, this is George W. Bush, understanding the history of our country is important for citizens. The Museum of the Confederacy provides an educational opportunity for visitors to experience the tragedy and triumph of a critical era in the American story. Through letters, books, photographs, and other artifacts in the museum, the American Civil War period comes alive.
Well, Ed Sebesta, what about this issue of the celebration of the Confederacy itself? Clearly, this has been an issue throughout the South, the issue of South Carolina and the flying of the Confederate flag there. And across the nation, there are those in the South who still regard the Battle of the Confederacy as just a heroic period of Southern history. And there are, of course, many in this nation who regard the Confederate flag and the Confederate states as the ultimate symbol of white supremacy in American history.
It's always been about white supremacy, and they may come down and talk the language of heritage, but in their own publications or in different venues, it's about white supremacy. I mean, the guy who coined the expression heritage, not hate, Lunsford, Charles Lunsford, and led the defense of the Georgia flag, got kicked out of the STV, Sons of Confederate Veterans, because unlike the rest of them, he was publicly associating with the Council of Conservative Citizens, and now currently he heads the Heritage Committee, the notorious League of the South. You know, and that's just one example. I mean, from beginning to end, from Alpha to Omega, it's been about white supremacy. And the Civil War is about slavery. Evidently, George Bush hasn't picked that up. It's not Hollywood tragedy drama. It's about slavery, and afterwards, it's white supremacy. And I'll make a point. E.A. Pollard wrote The Lost Cause, and that's where the book gave the name to this whole remembrance, Lost Cause. People don't know he also wrote The Lost Cause Regained, in which he states, listen carefully, the Civil War was not about slavery. The Civil War was about white supremacy, and slavery was just a mode of white supremacy. And that's, you know, from 1867 or whenever he published it to the present.
It's best we have to break for stations to identify themselves. And when we come back, this researcher on the neo-Confederate movement will be joined by James McPherson, who is professor of history at Princeton University, who attended the Lone Star Ball. I think we'll find out in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Ed Sebesta, researcher on the neo-Confederate movement, is our guest, as well as James McPherson, professor of history at Princeton University. Sorry, I think I got that wrong. Did not attend the Lone Star Ball, but has spoken at the Tredegar Iron Works Foundry, where these balls take place. Can you talk a little, Professor McPherson, about your thoughts about the Museum of the Confederacy?
Surely. Actually, I spoke at the Tredegar back in 1992 when it was still under the auspices of the Valentine Museum in Richmond, which is a museum mostly for the history of the city of Richmond. Subsequently, they had financial problems, and I'm not quite sure what the status of the Tredegar is now, but I know the Museum of the Confederacy is hoping to acquire it and administer it. I think... I agree 100% with Ed Sebesta that about the motives or the hidden agenda, not too deeply hidden, I think, of such groups as the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. They are dedicated to celebrating the Confederacy and a rather thinly veiled support for white supremacy, and I think that also is the, again, not very deeply hidden agenda of the Confederate flag issue in several southern states. I do think, though, that the Museum of the Confederacy, as it exists today, is in a different category. Its founding motives back in the 1890s, at the same time that the United Confederate Veterans and the Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans were founded, its founding motives were celebratory, but over time, and especially in the last decade or two, it has become a much more professional, research-oriented, professional exhibit-oriented facility.
But what about when you have, for example, these balls every year, like the Lone Star Ball that George Bush wrote the letter of congratulations for when they're, you know, it's, well, it takes place at the Tredegar, which is where they made the armaments. They wear period dress. They have all the flags of the Confederacy flying.
I think the motives of people who raise money for the museum and who attend balls in period costume and so on are probably range from celebratory to genuinely historical. So there is a dimension to that. But I do think that the Museum of the Confederacy is now a research and a professional museum in the same category as other highly regarded museums around the country. Some of its supporters, I'm sure, some of its sponsors, some of its members of the Board of Trustees are undoubtedly neo-Confederates. I do know that back in 1992 and 1993, the Museum of the Confederacy had a special exhibit on slavery and on the relationship of slavery in the Civil War, which the old guard in Richmond, who identified with the Confederate heritage, were very angry about, because that exhibit made all the same kinds of points that either Ed Sebester or I would make about the Civil War, that slavery was at the root of the conflict that led to the war. The slaves played a major part as labor force for the Confederacy, but also a major part as soldiers for the Union. And they've also had a good exhibit on Reconstruction and on the creative positive roles played by blacks in Reconstruction. So they have moved away from the celebratory and pro-slavery heritage that was involved in their founding. As far as George Bush's letter, yes, triumph and tragedy can be interpreted as ignoring the fundamental issue of the Civil War. Those words are ambiguous and vague depending on the context, but I didn't hear anything in that letter as you read it that endorses the Confederate cause.
There's a few points I would like to make.
Ed Sebester, go ahead.
Okay. Well, for starters, in the early 1990s, Ludwell Johnson was accepted as a museum fellow, so while they're becoming more professional, one of these leading neo-Confederate writers becomes one of their museum fellows, a regular contributor to the Southern Partisan. Book I have called Plantation Life in Texas by Texas A&M, and they tell about the bad things of slavery, but it's all done with watercolor pictures and this very flowing script, and so they're mentioning it, yet they're romanticizing it, and of course they sort of give the game away in the last part where they say, oh, you know, they're moaning over this plantation life going away and the horrors of Reconstruction coming, you know, and so I don't see it really having given up. I see them as adapting. I've been much more impressed if their book, Before Freedom Came, had an account of Robert E. Lee whipping his slaves and having brine poured in the wounds and cursing them. There's an account of that by one of his former slaves who tried running away and got caught, and gives an account and the cruelty and the viciousness by what they suffered under George General Lee.
Well, Ed Sebester, in mentioning Robert E. Lee, I noticed on the webpage of the Museum of the Confederacy that descendants of both Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart are featured as being heavily involved with the museum. So it almost seems that there is, I guess, since it is in Richmond, the former capital of the Confederacy, that they are, that there's an attempt to maintain sort of the heritage, the family heritages of some of the people involved.
Oh, definitely. I mean, to be a member of the UDC, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, you have to show descendants, you know, from some Confederate person or some person who during the Civil War in the Confederacy. And so there is, it is a familial thing. In fact, they even have a caste system in the UDC where they have granddaughters clubs and great-granddaughters clubs, and I think they even have a great-great-granddaughters club. You know, it's like this hereditary Southern aristocracy.
I wanted to ask about, you know, the whole controversy over the flag, too, and how George Bush gets involved with this, George W. Bush Jr. running for president. The South Carolina chapter of the NAACP has been putting increasing pressure for South Carolina to get rid of the Confederate battle flag that flies over the State House. The NAACP nationally has called for a tourism boycott of South Carolina. And Bush's response to this has been to tell people, quote, my advice is for people who don't live in South Carolina to butt out of the issue. He said the people of South Carolina can make that decision, you know, sort of getting to the sort of states' rights issue. Ed Sebesta, what's your response to this?
Well, there's even another thing that Bush did. A reporter down in Texas asked if it was flying over the Texas Capitol, would he support that? And he said that was hypothetical, and then afterwards he told the reporter, nice try. But the fact is he's not a neutral. He actually is a supporter of the Confederacy and has a record of doing that, and I think this is just sort of a public role. And the whole idea of localism is consistent with his sort of states' rights talk that he's been doing during his campaign, which is sort of the classic sort of lost cause argument. What do they fight for? They fought for states' rights. And So I think he's being a little disingenuous with this. His real reason, I think he found a reason, is to trying to get the voters or the people to support the Confederate flag, but he's also trying to have plausible deniability.
James McPherson, do you agree with this?
I don't know enough about Bush's position on the Confederate flag. I do know that the issue of the Confederate flag in South Carolina and also in Georgia, where the Confederate battle flag was incorporated into the state flag back in 1956, the flying of those flags does have a contemporary political agenda, and to the extent that any politician endorses that, I think Trent Lott did as well a couple of years ago, far more vigorously. I can't support them in doing that. I think there is a distinction between flying the Confederate flag in a museum or in a reenactment of battles or in other specifically historical contexts where that flag was part of the history that is being portrayed.
Well, Professor McPherson and Ed Sebesta, we wanted to go out of the show today with the comment speech given by Tom Turnipseed, who was formerly the national director for Alabama Governor George Wallace's presidential campaign. He says, I was a racist at the time, now one of the heads of the Center for Democratic Renewal, a civil rights organization. But I thank you both for being with us.
The flag that remains flying over the battlefield is a symbol of victory in our ancient heritage of mortal combat. When Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his troops to U.S. General Ulysses Grant to end the Civil War in 1865, Lee told his defeated Confederate troops to furl the flag of the Confederacy. The sovereignty and the flag of the United States of America were restored over the vanquished rebel states. The rebellious Confederacy, its battle flag, and its cause of states' rights to hold black people as chattel slaves had lost. The Civil War was the bloodiest war and most costly mistake in the history of the United States. It was caused by human bondage based on racism, an even greater mistake that continues to rend the social fabric of our nation. Tragically, the symbol of the lost cause of the Confederacy, the battle flag, was placed atop the South Carolina State House in the early 1960s to defy the civil rights movement's gathering momentum against racism. It remains there today less than 6 months from the new millennium. An underpinning of continuing racism is an illusory Southern heritage movement. Since the Civil War, the romanticization and glorification of the Confederacy and the Confederate battle flag have helped racism flourish as we Southerners honor our brave forebears who fought and died for dear old Dixie in the War of Northern Aggression. When I was the national director for Alabama Governor George Wallace's presidential campaign, I was a racist in denial, a part of the culture of Dixie that blindly accepted the Confederacy and its flag as symbols of a people who were persecuted for defending our precious Southern heritage. Until 25 years ago, I had shut my eyes in denial of who was suffering a much worse persecution at the hands of dear old Dixie, because I had been carefully taught that blacks were happy in their place, like Uncle Remus and old Black Joe. All of us who have honored the Dixie of slavery and segregation, where the darkies knew their place, must open our eyes to the historical fact that our Confederate ancestors made the monumental mistake of fighting for states' rights to continue the enslavement of African Americans in the southern states and to extend this peculiar institution westward. We must finally admit that the cause of slavery and second-class citizenship for blacks was and is not only a mistake but inherently wrong. We also need to finally understand that, thanks to the grace of God, the Confederacy lost the Civil War. Holding on to a heritage of ancestor worship and the mythology about Dixie and the rebel flag has helped to camouflage racial bigotry and oppression and kept many well-meaning Southerners in a state of denial about continuing racism in our own hearts and minds. The continuing persecution and atrocities against blacks in Dixie rival that of ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. From the beatings, castrations, and murders of slaves who tried to run to freedom or even acted too uppity, to the lynchings and house torchings of blacks by Ku Klux Klan night riders, the fire hosing and billy clubbing of civil rights protesters by policemen, and the burning of black churches by white supremacists. The Confederate battle flag is a universal symbol of militant white supremacists in Dixie as well as Germany and South Africa, where neo-Nazi skinheads and pro-apartheid extremists favor the rebel flag. I'm glad that National NAACP has called for an avoidance of South Carolina by visitors as long as the Confederate flag flies atop our capital. I'm sad, however, to hear the NAACP members called extremists. As a 25-year life member, I resent such remarks and efforts to use the flag as a political football and wedge issue. Racism is based on economic oppression by skin color, so it's appropriate that economic measures be used against it. A Mason-Dixon poll had South Carolinians favoring the flag's removal 48% to 41% in 1996. And there's a growing nonpartisan, multiracial, and religiously diverse movement of concerned citizens who will furnish the political will to remove the Confederate flag from atop the State House and both houses of the General Assembly. It includes many proud citizens of South Carolina and the United States who had beloved ancestors who fought and died in the Civil War, but who would tell us from their graves that it's time to furl the flag for the cause of truth and reconciliation for all God's children.
And that was Tom Turnipseed, former national director for Alabama Governor George Wallace's presidential campaign, now the president of the Center for Democratic Renewal. He ran on the Democratic line for Attorney General of South Carolina. He didn't win. That's the end of today's program. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In our game,
the deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid, and the marshals and cops get the same.